Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Jedis and Jokers and Jesuits, it must be Silicon Valley Comic Con 2016. This is TWiT Live Special number 278, recorded March 19th, 2016, Silicon Valley Comic Con. This TWiT Live Special is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/TWiT and enter the promo code TWiT. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit.
And I'm Patrick Delahanty.
And we are in San Jose, California for the Silicon Valley Comic-Con 2016. Now, Patrick, you are a veteran of these events, and this is the first time we've ever had a Silicon Valley Comic-Con. What can we expect?
Well, I've been to over 130 conventions, and usually the first years are not this crowded. This is amazing, the people that have turned out, and I think that's the power of Steve Wozniak and Stan Lee. And we've seen Star Wars and Star Trek and Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Comics, anime, all sorts of stuff. And it's amazing the amount of people that have turned out for this.
Yeah, this is a new experience for me, and it is one thing to watch video game characters right next to astromech droids and Jedis and you know, my favorite Avengers. Now, it's not just comic books, it's not just tech, it's not just geeks. There's also a fair number of celebrities. Everyone from William Shatner to
Adam Savage
was here. Actually, he walked right by to the principal cast of Back to the Future and Firefly. I'm telling you, this is a great geek celebration. Patrick and I are going to be showing you some of the best from the show floor of Silicon Valley Comic-Con.
Here at Silicon Valley Comic Con, I've found the droids I'm looking for. I'm here with the R2 builders and Brian.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. And his droid R2V1. And so R2V1, obviously an R2 unit in black. So tell us a little bit about R2V1.
So R2V1 was an Imperial version of the droid. Wanted to build a droid that was not R2-D2, the blue and whites that everyone's familiar with, so wanted something a little bit different. So I thought if Darth Vader had a sidekick, that would be him.
He looks pretty menacing. Now, about how long did this take you to assemble?
It took about a year and a half, 250 some odd hours.
That's quite a bit of dedication. And now I've been interested in building my own R2 unit. I want to build Chopper from Star Wars Rebels. And there is the resource, astromech.net.
Yeah, astromech.net.
Astromech.net, and you guys share a lot of resources, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So it's a club, so they're not kits, Chopper, R2, or otherwise. So basically you collect parts, people around the world that have ability to fabricate things, they sell parts, and you fabricate things yourself, you put it together yourself, probably takes a couple years to collect parts and to build it.
Yeah, and so did you build this out of plastic or metal, wood?
So this guy is all built out of plastic. The dome was vacuum-formed and laser-cut, so he's all plastic from head to toe. And aluminum is the other way to go, all aluminum.
Very cool. All right. And, no, he does all the sound effects and everything? And I see you've got an iPhone attached to your remote here.
Yeah, so the iPhone's basically Bluetooth. It's a soundboard, and that's just triggering all the sounds. And then the animation is all just a standard RC remote. That's pretty much it.
Very interesting. Well, I definitely have to get working on Chopper, so thank you very much.
Sure, you're welcome.
If you're one of the people who's been interested in virtual reality, then you know that there's a dearth of content. Which is why here at the Silicon Valley Comic Con, I'm speaking with Ryan from Google Spotlight Stores, who's going to explain why they're trying to fill the pipe with VR goodness. Ryan, what is Google doing with virtual reality content?
So we're making short films, essentially short interactive films in a full 3D environment. We found that VR was an interesting and unexplored avenue to tell stories, and so we're telling our stories with interesting creators. But so we have We have about seven now, I think, all about 5 minutes long, mostly animated. One live action that we did with Justin Lin called Help. Our newest one is this one called On Ice, which is a short animation about an ice skating event.
I got to ask you this. What's the difference between making a standard feature and a feature for VR? Because it's not just taking a 2D picture and making it 3D. There's an angle to the storytelling. What angle is that?
So far our biggest challenge has been essentially if you give the audience control of the camera, which is what you have to do in a like VR environment. You take away the director's traditional abilities to do pacing and framing that the audience decides where the camera goes, and the audience decides at what pace the show moves. So that what we have to do is we have to account for the audience's attention in how we organize the action of the show. You don't know when the audience is going to look at something, so you have to gauge their attention by what they're looking at and use that in order to change your story beats. If you want them to see something, you have to know that they're looking at it before you can make it happen.
We're seeing an explosion of VR equipment and VR content. We were actually at the Game Developers Conference this week in San Francisco, and one of the things that has been asked is, when will this content be universal? In other words, will we get to a point where it doesn't matter if I'm using Google Cardboard or Samsung Gear VR or PlayStation or Oculus? When will I be able to just have something like a Netflix for VR?
So we're right at the the front of VR development. I mean, some would say the second wave of VR development, but we're like, everyone's just exploring that right now, and everyone's essentially making their own tools for it. So I think it's going to be a little while, but in terms of the actual interactions, it all should be highly like portable. Like if you have one system that works, most of the other ones should. I actually don't have any idea when it's going to converge, but I do think it will. We're already available. Like, we have an app that's available through iOS and Android, and we have content that's available on YouTube. The convergence is already starting to happen. But how long it'll be, I think it'll be a little bit while longer.
Ryan, thank you very much for talking to us. Now, if they wanted to find out more about Spotlight, if they wanted to find out more about the shorts that are now available, where can they go?
So we have an app. It's called Google Spotlight Stories. It's available on iOS and on Android, on most phones. It's completely free. And we're also available on YouTube. We have a Google Spotlight Stories channel in which you can find all of these shorts on YouTube right now.
Thanks again. And if you're looking for VR content, remember, Google's in the spotlight.
When there's something strange at your Comic-Con, who are you going to call? The Bay Area Ghostbusters. I'm here with Ross, Azevedo, and Venkman. And so you guys are the Bay Area Ghostbusters, and you have your own Ecto-1. Tell me about it.
Well, it's a 1985 Buick that was originally a hearse, obviously, that was built to make up like the Ecto-1.
All right. And did you do this when you heard about the new movie that had this model of car, or did you do it ahead of time?
We actually did it ahead of time, and ironically, around the time that our first one had an electrical fire, we found out they were using the same model year for the new film. So it was just a series of coincidences. And then when we rebuilt this, it was kind of the body style is a nod to the new film, but the aesthetics and the color are from the originals.
Very cool. And you guys were, because of this, you were invited to a premiere down at Sony Pictures in Los Angeles. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was actually a lot of fun. We did that a few weeks ago. We got an early screening for the trailer. It was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed it.
Very cool. Now, you've also got the full-on proton packs and the outfit. Now, if somebody's interested in becoming a Ghostbuster, because, you know, they get that paranormal activity going on, what do they do? How do they take that first step?
The best source to go to is gbfans.com. I mean, they have all the parts, shells, uniforms, everything you need. Pretty much your one-stop shop for all paranormal needs.
Very cool. And so, thank you very much. And this is Patrick at Silicon Valley Comic Con with the Ghostbusters.
If you were alive this year, you probably heard of a little book that became a blockbuster movie called The Martian. Well, I'm with the author of The Martian, Mr. Andy Weir. Andy, it's so good to speak with you again. I had you on Padres Corner just as your movie was becoming the reality that is Hollywood. Tell me, what was that whole experience like? Because your story is one of, I don't want to call it a Cinderella story because that's overused, but it was a Cinderella story. It was a geek, a true geek, a programmer who decided that he wanted to write some hard fiction, and you came up with it. And then it became Hollywood. Tell me about that.
Well, it's been a complete change of my life in every way. I was a computer programmer who sat in a cubicle all day, just kind of quietly doing my job. Now I'm traveling around, going to like media events, hanging out with movie stars and stuff like that. It's this complete change of every aspect of my life. But I would say the biggest change is just in my daily work schedule. Being a computer programmer is a lot more social. You work on a team. You've got a whole bunch of people. You're all working together for a common goal. It's very group oriented. A lot of teamwork, a lot of social interaction. I'm a kind of outgoing guy, so I really like that. And then being a writer is just me alone in my house with sort of a number of words I want to get done that day. And it took me a while to adjust to that much more like solo lifestyle. I mean, I still have lunches and dinners with my friends and stuff, but I'm alone all day, and that was a change.
That might be the shocking statement of Comic-Con, that being a writer is more social than being a programmer, but I think our audience understands.
No, other way around.
Oh, other way around, yeah. Other way around. Now, I got to ask this. We have geeks, a lot of geeks on our network. They love your book. They love the audiobook. In fact, I'd say you get the book and the audiobook because each lends a little bit of something.
Oh, yeah.
They
the narrator did a great job.
Yeah, R.C. Bray, he narrated. He did a fantastic. He won an award for it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
But there was always this thing that happens whenever a beloved book becomes a movie where you realize, I'm not going to get everything. But I was sitting through The Martian the first time I watched it, and I was thinking, you know what? They didn't get everything, and they didn't get the minutiae that I loved so much about the book. But they managed to capture the spirit. I mean, it was really there. They kind of changed the story so that it would fit in 2 hours. But you, as the author, how did you feel about seeing your work get condensed and then change slightly and then really kind of shoehorned into a 2-hour slot?
I think they did a fantastic job with the adaptation. I've got no complaints at all. I mean, yeah, they had to leave some stuff out, otherwise it'd be a 5-hour movie. So something had to go. And the things that they cut, this was all done by Drew Goddard, who wrote the screenplay, a fantastic screenwriter. And the things he cut are, if it had been left up to me, I would have cut the same things. They were self-contained storylines that didn't matter to the overarching plot. And so by trimming the things they did, they didn't have to change anything else. So I think they did a fantastic job. And Matt Damon absolutely nailed the role of Watney. I mean, just absolutely perfectly captured his personality.
Well, I mean, he was supposed to be that dry Boston humor. I think he captured dry Boston humor. One of the interesting things is we get a lot of nitpickers. And it's, you know, it's not a mean thing.
I'm a nitpicker.
I'll be the first to admit it. I'm a nitpicker, for sure.
During our first interview, you confessed that there were two major issues that you just sort of did in order to advance the plot. And the first one, and you have talked about this many times, you talked about it with Adam Savage, you've talked about it on national TV, and that is a 100-mile-per-hour storm on Mars wouldn't really be all that much force.
Right, correct, yeah. It would barely be able to knock over a piece of paper, let alone a 27-ton spacecraft. Yeah.
But a gentle breeze probably isn't that much of a visual effect for a movie, I'm thinking.
Well, and also not a threat of any kind, right? I've since learned, you know, when I wrote the book, I didn't know anyone in aerospace at all. I was on my own. And now I know a whole bunch of people. And I've since learned from them that Mars has lightning. I wish I'd known that because I could have had a lightning strike, cause an explosion or something that leads to all the problems. But I didn't know that at the time.
You have to save that for The Martian 2,
yeah.
The Martianing.
The Martians.
Martians, too.
Martians.
The other nitpick that people get a lot, and actually you talked about this on the podcast, was the miracle have canvas that would somehow keep him from getting so much cancer that the cancer would have cancer doesn't actually exist.
That's true. It doesn't exist. However, I recently read a paper, like a scientific paper that somebody wrote. I wish I could remember the author's name because I'd love to credit him. But where he went through a detailed analysis of the total radiation dosage that Watney and, more importantly, the rest of the crew would have received. Because Watney spends most of his time on Mars during this whole ordeal. And he... most of the radiation you receive in space is from GCRs, galactic cosmic rays, which are high-energy particles just moving in random directions. Wadney was on Mars for most of the time, so half of the angles were blocked by the planet itself. So, like, Mars itself protected him from half of the radiation. But the crew got blasted by galactic cosmic rays the entire time, like the rest of them, Commander Lewis and the others. And so it turns out that they're... He calculated their total radiation dosage and their mortality odds and stuff like that. And the worst of them would be Lewis and Johansson, because for reasons we don't fully understand, women are more susceptible to getting cancer from radiation than men are. Johansson and Lewis would have about a 3% chance of dying earlier in life than they should from radiation. That's it. That's it. So it's actually, like, even though... At the time I wrote it, I thought, I'm hand-waving around the radiation. It actually wasn't that bad. And part of the reason... This guy did a detailed analysis. Part of the reason is because it was a period of solar maximum activity, meaning the sun is at its maximum level of solar activity, which creates a very strong magnetic field around our entire solar system, which deflects GCRs and reduces the amount of incoming galactic cosmic rays. So this is a really cool article. Anyway, point is, it's not a problem.
And actually, you even put a line in the book, in the original script, about how Venkat says, you don't figure this, but Wadney is actually safer than the crew in deep space. He's on a planet. All right, I have to ask this. What has changed? I mean, yes, you've talked about how your life has changed from top to bottom. You are now a bona fide writer. You have a script that has made millions and millions of dollars in Hollywood. But what is the thing that you most can look at every morning and say... This is my new life. This is what I do now.
That's a tough call, because mostly what I look at in the morning is like my own computer. So that hasn't really changed much. I guess what it comes down to is the people I talk to and the projects I'm talking about, you know. So instead of like talking to my peers and friends and whatnot about like, oh, we're going to... we're going to implement this feature. We're going to change this thing. Now I'm having phone calls with people where it's like, oh, well, actually, you know, I'm pitching this TV show. I'm going to write a screenplay for Fox and that sort of stuff. And so it's like this totally different order of magnitude. And just all these famous people that I'm interacting with casually. And it's I would say that's the biggest change.
Andy, let's talk a little bit about life past the Martian. Right. Yeah, you are an author. I know you're hard at work. Can you talk anything about upcoming books, upcoming projects? What's next for Andy Weir?
I'm working on my next book now. It's another hard sci-fi, as in realistic science fiction story. And this one takes place in a city on the moon. Takes place in the 2080s, 2090s time frame. I haven't settled on a title for it yet, so I don't have one for you. But, yeah, and it's about actually a woman who's a criminal.
I like this. Well, when you get closer, make sure to give Twit a call, because we'll get you on the air. We'll talk about it. Anyone who can write something as fanciful and wonderful as The Martian, we want on Twit TV.
Well, thanks. A lot of pressure on me, though. You know, so I've just got to kind of accept that, like, my next book is not likely to be better than The Martian. So I just need to say, like, all right, well, if it entertains people, if people have a fun time reading it, it doesn't have to, you know, be better. It just needs to be good.
We've been speaking with Andy Weir. He is the author of the best-selling book and audiobook, The Martian, as well as the Academy-nominated motion picture. Thank you so very much for speaking with us again. Thank you for being part of the Twit Army. If they wanted to find out more about your work, more about your book, and more about your upcoming projects, where can they go?
Probably andyweirauthor.com would be the best place.
There you have it, folks. You want hard fiction? You want Andy Weir.
I'm here at Silicon Valley Comic Con with the largest private Star Wars collection in the world, Rancho Obi-Wan, and I'm here with Steve Sansweet.
Hi, good to see you.
Good to see you too. Now, you guys are neighbors in Petaluma.
We are. I don't know why we haven't gotten together yet, but we'll have to make sure that happens. I mean, you're not in former chicken barns. We are. 9,000 square feet of chicken barn, housing about 300,000 plus items from Star Wars, going back all the way to the beginning.
That's incredible. And my mother thought I had a lot of Star Wars in the basement, but wow. Now, how did you get started with this?
I started with one object. I grew up loving science fiction, and then I was working at the Wall Street Journal in Los Angeles, and a reporter got a really beautiful color booklet from Fox in early 77 promoting the movie, mainly for the movie studios, you know, try to get people to book the movie. and he threw it away. And when he left for the day, I just sort of toddled over to his trash can, and that was my first rescue of a Star Wars item and dumpster diving, but I've done it many times since.
And now you've got just about everything ever made, correct?
Well, a large percentage, although with Disney constantly putting out new things, it becomes very difficult. So I'm concentrating on the things that I really love. And one of those, starting about 10 years ago, was fan-made items and art, because that shows the true passion of the fans, and that's one of the things we do as a nonprofit. We try to inspire other people, give out tours to other charities to auction off, and bring in school kids and talk about whatever the teacher wants to talk about.
Now, when did you change this from just a collection to a museum and open Rancho Obi-Wan?
It'll be our fifth anniversary this coming November that we became a corporation and a nonprofit 501c3. And that was because the amount of stuff became overwhelming, and we didn't have enough space for it. And then our PR person, Consetta Parker, who is a good friend, and Ann Newman, who's the general manager, said, "Steve, we've got to incorporate and become a nonprofit so you can actually bring people in here. We have events. I do weddings. I actually marry people." And then we set out, and it was about 2010, I guess. And I knew at some point I'd be leaving Lucasfilm as head of fan relations. And that's when we started building, and we opened officially in November 5th, 2011 as a nonprofit.
Very nice. And it's great that you bring a sample of your collection out here to the convention for everyone to see.
Yeah, it's and we try to pick all kinds of different things. We have done the big Star Wars celebration events. And since this is the first Silicon Valley Comic Con, we've brought things like, the highest tech that we could find from 20 years ago, a box of 1.4 megabyte floppy disks with a Star Wars screensaver on it. And some kid looks at this thing and says, "You can't get a movie on, you can't even get a JPEG on this." So it's fun to see how technology has quickly changed too.
Very true. And now if somebody's interested in visiting Twit and Rancho Obi-Wan, they're both in Petaluma, same trip, how can they get in touch with Rancho Obi-Wan and get a tour?
You can go on to RanchoObiWan.org, and we have all of our information. We have blogs, we have photos, and it tells you how to become a member. And our tour calendar, it runs out about 4 months in the future, and you can book a tour in advance. All the details are there.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And so if you're looking to take a tour of Petaluma, have some wine, visit Twit, and visit Rancho Obi-Wan, it's the perfect place. Come check us out.
When is a VR movie not a VR movie? When it's a Monster VR. I'm here with Michael Wolf from Monster VR, who's going to explain their philosophy of what VR is done when it's done right. Michael, you've chosen to use the HTC Vive to create sort of a mountain climbing cooperative game. Why?
Why? Well, it seems that the next frontier with virtual reality is this interactive, immersive environment. And what a lot of people aren't doing right now are really putting the player in control over where they are and what's going on. Here, we can move the entire player around. The entire tracking space moves as we climb. So that means that we can have them go anywhere they choose as long as they are able to grab onto the environment that we give them. So with this, we went with this candy theme because it was nice and simple, very readable. And we... you can have it so you can grab onto these gummies and pull yourself up, and you're simply just moving the entire space. I like to explain it as you room scale VR, instead of having a player who you're moving around, you have a box with a player inside it that you're moving around.
A lot of people don't realize how much of a change this is from what we've been seeing in VR. VR, typically we've seen some fantastic demonstrations that has the player on a predetermined route. You move through a scene, maybe you can interact with the scene, but most of them don't have the capability to have the player actually interact in the way that you do at Mountain VR. What challenges are there in creating that kind of programming?
Well, For starters, what happens when they can't move around anymore? What if somebody moves themselves in a way that puts them unable to move? So we do have to control that environment. We need to make sure that if they fall, they respawn in a position that they'll able to grab and move around again. We kind of set it up with a nice friendly little barrier with comfort, so to speak. But we make it as diverse as we can. And so here in our game, we'll see we have these green path, the yellow path, and the red path, which is easy, medium, and hard in difficulty. And there are different approaches that you go, but we have control over, hey, are you going to fall and land somewhere you can't pick yourself up from? So, yeah.
Michael, one last question, and that is, VR sets have become almost kind of a fighting word for many people. Some people are really down with Oculus. Some people love the HTC Vive. I was a big fan of the PlayStation 4 that was revealed at the Game Developer Conference. Why did you choose the HTC Vive? And how do you see that playing out in the future between the three or four sets that have become dominant?
A lot of people tend to think that we've got a new console war on our hands. But I don't really think it's going to be that way, since people are a lot more sophisticated about it. It's going to be easy to port between individual console. However, the HTC Vive has the best room scale tracking. It has the best tracking with control of your hands and moving the environment, because that's what they've been focusing on. Oculus is going to be coming up with its Touch, which will be doing tracking of the hands, but it won't be as refined and well done as the HTC Vive. Meanwhile, the PlayStation 4, sure, they have their Move, but it's still not at the level that the HTC Vive provides.
Michael, if they wanted to find out more about Monster VR, more about the work that you've been doing, where can they go?
You can go to monstervr.com. We have a big poster right up here.
Michael, thank you very much for sharing your tech. Thank you for speaking with us. Now, if you want to see exactly how this works, make sure to check out the know-how special, because we're going to be sitting with Michael and actually taking a look at some of his programming secret sauce. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballester from Silicon Valley Comic Con at the Monster VR booth. If you want VR, you want Monster.
I'm here with Andrew Main, the author of Station Breaker, Public Enemy Zero, and many other great books. He should be very familiar to longtime viewers of Twit. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Good to see you, Sir Patrick. How are you?
I'm pretty good. And so I'm really excited about this new book, Station Breaker.
Thank you.
And so tell us a little about this.
Station Breaker is an action sci-fi story, but it's set in the very near term. So it's kind of like Gravity meets Bourne Identity, in the sense that it's stuff that's happening kind of right now. If you like space, like SpaceX and what's going on with the reusable rockets, it's kind of a Tom Clancy-esque thriller set in the near term.
Very cool. I can't wait to read this. But you've written so many books in such a short period of time. It's amazing. How do you do that?
I have no social life, Patrick, so it's pretty easy. When, Friday nights are empty, I just write.
Well, you did write the book, How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours. And do you actually write these in 24 hours?
No, it depends. So Public Enemy Zero was a book that I wrote that first draft in 10 days, and then that was actually a book that very much the success of that happened because of, the Twit audience and being able to share that with people who had sort of similar interests. And then other books like Station Breaker is one. I probably spent a couple months on that. And then I did write the first draft of Game Night in 24 hours. That was just to show, this is what happens when you write something in 24 hours. Not that I advocate that you do that for every book, but sometimes, you want to take an idea and get it out there as quickly as you can rather than sit on it forever and go, maybe I should, So it depends. They all varies.
Right. And now for people who like the Comic Cons, they probably like Public Enemy Zero because it has Dragon Con in there.
Yeah, Dragon Con's the finale. Spoiler alert. You don't know what happens there, all right? Everybody could die. So, yeah, Dragon Con features into that, and that was after having gone to Dragon Con. I'm like, man, I want to use this because this is sort of a really neat element. And so, yeah, it's got certainly has elements of con culture in it.
Yeah, I loved that. Now, if people want to find out more about you and your books, where can they do that?
So I'm at andrewmain.com. which is easiest way to that's M-A-Y-N-E. And I have a mailing list. And one of the things I do on my email list is I tend to give away free copies of books. So people who are on my email list, they got free ebooks of How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours. First, they got Station Breaker. I gave away free copies there because I try to use my email list as a way to build up momentum and interest in my books. I have a new book coming out, The Cure for Writer's Block, which I'm going to probably just send that out to everybody on there. So that's a reason to sign up, andrewmain.com.
And your books are also on Amazon, too, right?
You can find me on Amazon. Amazon, Name of the Devils and Barnes & Noble right now. That's with HarperCollins. Same with Angel Killer. So you can find those books probably in bookstores, but in Amazon is an easy place to find me.
Very cool. And I can't wait to read Station Breaker. I'm bringing this on my honeymoon, believe it or not.
Sounds like an exciting honeymoon.
We'll see how much I get through. But, Andrew, good to see you.
For her sake, I hope not at all.
Okay. We'll get back to our coverage of the Silicon Valley Comic Con, but first let's go ahead and take a moment to thank our sponsor of this special, Casper. Now, Casper is a manufacturer of premium mattresses that breaks the mold that you may know for mattress purchasing. Now, let me ask you, when you bought your last mattress, what did you do? You probably went to some sort of mattress showroom, maybe spent 20 minutes, 30 minutes lying down or on five or six different models. Well, folks, that's no way to choose your mattress. That's no way to choose something that you're going to be spending 20, 30, 40% of your life on. Now, Casper understands that, so they have a guarantee. They will ship the mattress to your home, let you try it out, and if you don't like it, you ship it back. That's just part of the reason why Casper is a part of the Twit Army. Now, Casper understands because their obsessively engineered mattress comes at a fair price. Even though it is crazy comfortable, even though Leo and Lisa sleep on it, Casper understands that most people want something that's going to be a bargain, going to be a value, and they've priced their mattresses to be that. It's comfortable, and it has just the right sink and bounce. A Casper mattress provides long-lasting comfort and support. Also, it keeps you cool throughout the night with its breathable open-cell design. They've actually combined different technologies to give it the right amount of softness, the right amount of support. They offer you free delivery and painless returns. This is that 100-day period where you can decide whether or not it's right for you. And here's the thing. You get to decide with the mattress in your home, in your bedroom, exactly as you're going to be using it at night. There is no other business that will let you do the same. Customers who purchase a Casper mattress rated a 4.6 out of 5 stars. You should try sleeping on a Casper mattress today and see if it might up your sleep count just as much. Also, check out Casper's pillows. Their responsive dual-layer pillows adapt to your movement through the night, and they match the mattress, giving you that unique, complete, integrated sleep experience. Casper mattresses are made in the United States of America, so you can feel at home knowing that you're buying from your country. Folks, get a Casper mattress today. $500 for a twin or $950 for a king size. Compared to industry averages, that's an outstanding price. And you can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members. Just go to casper.com/twit and enter the promo code TWIT. That's casper.com/twit with the promo code TWIT. Terms and conditions apply. For details, visit casper.com/terms. And we thank Casper for their support of this Twit Live special. If you're going to go to a Comic-Con, there's one essential accessory, and that's a lightsaber. Which is why I'm speaking with Amanda from the lightsaber team to explain how you can build your very own. Amanda, of course, this is a geek icon. This is a sci-fi treasure. Everyone should have a lightsaber. What do you do to make that happen?
Well, we work with people in our organization. This is actually built from somebody within our team, made from aluminum and polycarbonate. And this, the polycarbonate blade is held in place with a set screw. And this makes them combat ready. So these are not just for sitting around on a shelf. And these are also not kids' toys.
We actually had a team come by our studio about a year and a half ago, and they showed us what lightsaber combat looks like. And you know, there's always that sort of, oh, yeah, it's just a bunch of kids swinging plastic swords. But if done right, it's beautiful. It's incredibly well choreographed. How do you train people to do that?
Well, we start with some warm-up routines, just trying to practice striking in different areas. We try to avoid what we call touching sticks, which is like, you know, just kind of being like kids batting things around. So we actually do try to go for some kill shots. But then also we have to practice the blocking of that. So that's how we get practice for that. And then we carefully practice our choreography until it is perfect.
We all know that every young Jedi's training is not complete until they construct their own lightsaber. What what kind of materials can they choose? So when you have someone who says, oh, look, I want to build my own saber, what are the choices? What are the options? How cheap? How expensive? What do they get to choose as far as blade construction is concerned?
Well, they can choose aluminum, certainly some sort of metal. These are aluminum, which keeps them nice and lightweight. Some of the more professional manufacturers go up as high as with like steel and things like that, which makes them very heavy. And there's also different things, acrylics that can be sprayed on them for grip. And then what we use and all of ours, like I said, is polycarbonate, which is a type of plastic used for stopping bullets. So it's definitely combat ready, and you can hit each other, well, not each other, but hit the blades with it at a high impact.
Amanda, thank you very much for speaking with us. Now, if they wanted to find out more about your organization, more about the lightsaber team, more about where they could build one of these, where can they go?
They can go. The best place to go is our Facebook page, Lightsaber Team Facebook page, or our website, which www.lightsaberteam.com.
Thanks again for speaking with us. I'm Father Robert Ballister at the Silicon Valley Comic Con. And audience, you have disappointed me for the last time. Times used to be that if you wanted to make a production, you had to get a multi-million dollar studio behind you. You had to have big contracts. You had to have a huge payroll. You had to have an overhead that was an overhead of an overhead. Well, those times don't exist anymore because we've got outfits like Legion M. I'm speaking with Paul and Jeff, the principals behind Legion M, who are going to explain why the game has changed. Gentlemen, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. We appreciate being here.
Now, what is Legion M?
So, Legion M, well, we just launched today at Silicon Valley Comic Con. Legion M is the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. So for the first time in history, we're allowing fans to come in, be a part of our company, the creation of the company, not only as like the creative and getting involved in the process, but having an investment in the projects. So for the first time in history, we're allowed to allow those fans to make an investment. We'll give actual shares. They'll own a piece of the company. And as we create content and bring it to market, they'll come along for the ride.
Jeff, this seems to be sort of a natural progression of what we've seen in fan studio interaction. It used to be, well, fans might have a little bit of input. You might have a popular character that you want to be played out. Then it became, well, fans could actually support. You could crowdsource. You could crowdfund a production that you really wanted to see going. This seems to be the next level, which is it's not just that we'll take your input. It's not just that we'll take your money, but we'll actually help you create.
Absolutely. I mean, you hit the nail right on the head. It's really, when you look at how powerful Kickstarter and Indiegogo and platforms are like that for creating new projects, but also the engagement that it creates between the fan and the artist, for the fan to really be a part of a project. And we're taking that whole thing to an entirely new level, because now it's not, you know, you're not just involved with the funding in it, but you truly are an owner of it. And if this content is successful, you're going to get a return. And, you know, it takes that magic and takes it to a whole new level that's really exciting.
I mean, it always is nice to see something that you've helped to fund or you've helped to give ideas to make it to the big screen. But you're right. If you actually have an investment in it, if you can receive part of your investment back by producing something that people love, well, that's that next level. I got to ask either of you. Yeah. There are going to be those who say, wait a minute. A movie, a production, a serious piece of content has one director, one producer, one person who has the vision, who assembles it, who makes it look and feel the way he or she makes it, wants it to look. And then they're going to say, but it sounds like this is anarchy. This is multiple voices coming in. Don't you put too many chefs in the kitchen?
That's absolutely right. I mean, Legion M is about empowering the creators. Everybody knows that great art isn't created by committee. So we want the fan, the Legion, we want them to get involved and get behind these creators, right? They can help us discover new creators, and I think that's an amazing opportunity. But, you know, if we're working with Stupid Buddy Studios, the creators of Robot Chicken, we know that they know how to create great content, and they have a loyal fan base. We're part of their fan base. We want to support them in their next endeavor. Now, with that said, we do also want the fans to feel involved and to have a voice. So it's a balancing act, but we'll be working with the creators and helping them acknowledge that they have a fan base that they can go to when they need an opinion on something. A lot of times the director will be working on something. It's not timely to go get a focus group together or do anything like that. In this case, if they have a casting question or a wardrobe question or, you know, even something more important than that, they have the fan base accessible to them. And so as a fan, you will have authenticated access to this entire experience. You'll get to see everything that's going on behind the scenes. You will do live streams from the set. We'll have periodic conference calls with the director and the cast. We'll allow for, like, polling and voting on certain things. We may actually take a series of pilots and put them out to the fan base and say, hey, look, we've got five different projects that we're looking at. What do you guys think of these? And get that feedback and use that input to guide us.
All right, let's get down to brass tacks.
All right.
Let's say I'm an aspiring artist. I'm an aspiring creator. I'm talent. I'm an editor. I'm a camera person. I want to be involved. Yeah. I come to Legion M. What can you do for me? Who can you connect me with? How can you make my project, my dream come to life?
Great question. Great question. So right now there's just a contact form on the website. And so if you want to be involved or if you've got an idea, you can submit it there. We're not actively soliciting submissions right now, but we expect to be, and there'll be a process, and if you sign up now, then you'll be on the list once that stuff comes out. But like Paul said, a big part of this is we want to empower creators. We've got an amazing creative alliance with the Stupid Buddies guys and Meltdown and Animal Repair Shop, and part of what we're doing is developing projects that are in their pipeline, the things that they've created that are, you know, that are a perfect fit to be fan built by the fans. But the other part of it is we want to use them and the Legion to discover this next generation of talent and provide the mentorship and infrastructure that allows them to be successful.
Gentlemen, this is fantastic. This is exciting. This is the sort of announcement that you hope to hear at a Comic-Con or two, you know, because you're actually letting the people in this audience come and bring their ideas to the screen. So yeah. Kudos to you.
Now, Thank you.
If they wanted to find out more about Legion M, if they wanted to find out about the two of you, if they wanted to read about how this idea came to be, where should they go?
They should go to thelegionm.com. It's our website. It's got a lot of information about our background, the team, our creative allies, the type of projects we're going to get involved in. And you can also reserve your share. If it's interesting to you, you can reserve your share. Again, it's a non-binding commitment. So if you change your mind later, that's no problem. We won't hold a grudge against you. But if you do decide to invest, you've locked in your spot when we do the IPO this summer.
Paul, Jeff, thank you so very much. Thank you for sharing your vision.
Thank you, Padre.
And folks, if you're looking for the latest content, just remember, our name is Legion, and we are many.
I'm here with Steven Sears, the author of The Non-User-Friendly Guide to The Non-User-Friendly Guide for Aspiring TV Writers. That's not a short title.
Yeah, I wanted to fit on a T-shirt.
But it's a very descriptive title.
Yes, as a matter of fact. That's a book that actually I don't teach anybody how to write, because I honestly, seriously don't know how to do that. I kind of learned intuitively. But that book is basically a lot of anecdotes and practical information for working in the television industry.
Now, you've got quite a bit of experience working in the television industry. You've worked on Xena.
Mm-hmm. I was the co-exec producer and one of the head writers for Xena, Warrior Princess.
And writer on A-Team and Riptide and...
One of my first shows was Riptide was actually my first show. My second show was the A-Team, and then Hardcastle McCormick, Stingray, Raven, J.J. Starbuck, did I say that? Walker, Texas Ranger, Swamp Thing, Superboy, Jesse Hawks, Grand Slam, Hardball, and I actually can't remember all my credits, which is kind of cool, actually.
Well, you have that many. I'm not surprised you can't remember. That's impressive. And now I have heard that you do have the Riptide robot.
I do. If anybody out there has watched Riptide or knows of Riptide, it's about three guys. They're detectives. They live on a boat. Two studly guys and one geeky guy who developed a thing called the Robaz, a little orange robot. And I have that robot.
Does he actually work?
No, we had three different versions of him. One of them would move around. One of them lit up and had lights. And one was just to sit there and look beautiful. Well, we disassembled the one that lit up and used it in something else we did later. And I think the one that actually drove and moved kind of rolled off the boat one time. So the only one left was that standalone. And, yeah, I ended up with that.
Very cool. Now, for any aspiring TV writers, are there any just quick tips that you could give to give a sample of what's in here?
Oh, sure. In fact, a lot of the book is actually a lot of philosophy about how to survive in this business. You have to know your core. You have to know who you are. Be confident in yourself. The one thing you're going to hear from every successful person in the industry when they are asked, how do you become successful? The most common thing is they say perseverance. You've just got to keep at it. But you have to constantly work at it. You have to allow your little creative child to come out and run around. I fell into it totally by accident. I never planned to be a writer, never planned to be a producer. I fell into it by accident, and I did it because I loved it. And eventually I'll figure out what I'm going to do with my life. But until then, I'll just keep doing this.
Now, what was it you originally planned to do?
I was an actor. Perhaps you did not see that. How's my lighting? I originally came to Los Angeles as an actor. I was... got a degree in theater from Florida State University. Go Noles! And I came out here, got an entry-level position in a restaurant as a waiter, and started writing audition scenes for myself. And my audition scenes started being done at showcases. People were getting copies of it. And on advice from a casting director, I decided to try writing a script. And at the same time, I met a friend at the restaurant named Bert Pearl, and he and I became best friends, and we started writing together. I made one phone call to Stephen Cannell Productions just to ask a question. The person gave me some advice, and off of that advice, we sent in material and were hired on staff. And Bert and I worked as a team for about 5 years. Then I went on to do things like Cena. He went on to be executive producer for Touched by an Angel. So he went to Christian. I went to Pagan. It was kind of weird. but yeah, I just fell into it.
Very cool. Now, if people want to get your book or if they want to learn more about you, where can they get more information?
Well, if you Google Stephen L. Sears, the L is important, you will find all sorts of references. Usually you'll see a lot of pictures of my dog, Julian. I have a website called Pondali. I'm not going to bother spelling that. You'll see it when you Google my name. I have a Facebook page and a Facebook fan page. The book is available, of course, on Amazon. It's also available from Wordfire Press. So it's hard for me to hide, so you can find me almost anywhere.
This is Stephen L. Sears, the author of the Non-User-Friendly Guide for Aspiring TV Writers. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
We're in the bowels of Silicon Valley Comic Con, where there is an arcade. Now, it's not just any arcade. It's a free arcade. And it's not just a free arcade. It's a free arcade created by students. I'm with James, the advisor to the Game Developer Club at San Jose State University, who is responsible for creating this wonderful array of 80s nostalgia. James, what is behind me?
So what we have behind us is two arcade cabinets that we built. We built them over at the tech shop. We got our own plans for them, and then one of them is the Winnetron. So the Winnetron is the winners from the Winnipeg Independent Games Festival from 2012. And then the other cabinet is our games that we've developed, we made as part of the club, as part of classes, just at San Jose State, because that's what we love to do.
We've seen this trend in the maker community, and especially in the geek community, over the last couple of years, where, yeah, you can get a console. Sure, you could get a high-powered PC. Yes, you could get the latest and greatest graphics, but there's something visceral. There's something that's just wonderful about combining the design of a cabinet along with the electronics, along with the programming, to make your own game. How do you inspire that in your students?
Well, if you look at the cabinets, they're cheats. They're gigantic pieces of furniture, but inside of them is just a PC. And the PC will then just maps the keyboard out to the controllers. But the thing is that when you're operating the controls, it's so different than sitting there at a keyboard. And that's one of the things that we found that people really like. And so we use it as a way to encourage people. We take these to half a dozen shows every year. And Comic-Con this year, what could be better?
Yeah, speaking of what could be better, these are just stand-up machines. They're a fusion of disciplines. You've got designers, you've got programmers, you've got electrical and computer engineers. When someone comes into the club, what kind of experience do they have? What kind of experience are you most looking for? And what do they learn over the course of, say, a year?
So there are two main areas that people come in with. They come in with excuse me, art
art background and computer science, but you're right, it spans every discipline. There's like there's writing, there's quality testing, there's like level design, there's like game design. Like anything that you can imagine, specific subject matter is also really useful. So so some people come in, most people come in with no experience, and we connect them with a team that helps them understand then like the different jobs that they can take on. But then we also have people come in who like really know programming. Like I've had some programmers come in and are from the CS program, which is like really well ranked in the in the area and so forth. And they've come in and they find game programming and they realize like, oh wow, I can do this, and this involves everything that I've learned so far too.
James, we of course have been speaking with the advisor for the Game Developer Club at San Jose State University. If they wanted to find out more about your club, more about your program, more about San Jose State University, where can they go?
The Game Developer Club is open to the public. We meet in the library on Thursdays, like 7:30, which is actually convenient for people who have jobs and so forth. But it's primarily for students, open to the public.
James, thank you very much for sharing your passion, sharing your tech, and sharing your program. Folks, if you want to show your passion, get playing.
I'm here with the crew of the Battlestar Galactica. And so, guys, you guys made all these outfits yourselves?
Yeah.
And so, did one of you coordinate? Because they all look very well coordinated. Did one of you handle it, and then some? You all fit it?
That would be me. Yeah.
Very nice. What made you want to cosplay as Battlestar Galactica?
I think it's one of those things where we really enjoyed the show. The costuming for the show is just amazing, and I think it's one of those like just the people that like the show. And like costuming, it's kind of a natural gravitation, just happens.
Right. Now, these are not simple costumes. I've looked into doing this myself, and I mean, you've got all the pockets, and just the material alone is difficult to find, and all the pins and everything. How did you manage that?
Well, as far as getting the material, it's a minimum run situation, so you get together with, 60 of your closest friends on the internet, gather up about $9,000 and buy a roll of fabric, and then just start making them, and, some you send out, but it's a lot of scouring online, talking with other people that have looked up different pieces of the costume, and everyone watching out for each other and sharing what you find and making it happen. So,
great. Now, do you all have your own call signs here?
Twofer. Freya.
Sock Monkey.
Duster.
Great. And thank you for your service on the Battlestar Galactica. And is there a site where people can find out more about yours? Do you put pictures online or anything?
Well, the site for our company is Midwick Armory, but we're also part of the Colonial Fleet, which is an amazing organization that brings a bunch of fans together. So,
very nice. Thank you. Excellent costumes. So say we all.
It's been a long day here at the Silicon Valley Comic Con, its first year ever in San Jose, California. Patrick, what have you seen? There have been some miraculous things on the floor, from video games brought to life, from my favorite anime characters, to some really, huge name stars coming to speak to the crowds.
Yeah, Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox are here. Plus, I've never seen a comic convention with such a merging of tech and nerdery. Yeah. So you've got the comics and you've got the VR stuff. Yeah. You've got the cosplay, and you've got apps. And it's incredible how they've merged it. And I think that that's something that Woz and Stan Lee, it really shows that the two of them have teamed up to bring these two worlds together.
Now, we really have to give all the credit to Woz and Stan. And actually, Woz is so excited. He actually stood in here for us to do this segment to show how dedicated he is to Comic-Con. We have seen things like astromech droids. We've been able to open up their chassis to see how they're made.
We've seen a new Ghostbusters car.
Exactly. Yeah. What I love about this is it's like a combination of Maker Faire, South by Southwest, and everything that you loved about the 80s, growing up, reading comic books and geeking out. This really is a safe place for people to be nerds.
Yeah, everybody here seems to be having a great time, and they're loving it.
Yeah. Hey, is there anything you want to add?
He's speechless.
Speechless. Folks, that's the word from the Uncanny Valley here at Silicon Valley Comic Con in San Jose, California.